The June issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow, which means we have Gemma Tarlak back with us to preview some of the month's coolest science stories.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the top science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Always great to be talking to you.
Well, you cover this month a really fascinating story about a solar-powered plane. And it kind of seems like a tall order to power this highly complex machine, an airplane, via solar power. How does it work?
Well, the Solar Impulse 2, it's actually kind of the sequel to the original that they crossed the country with last year. This is going to be the first round-the-world flight, and they're testing it now for a 2015 flight. But basically, they worked on making it very, very light with a huge wingspan. For example, the wingspan is longer than a 747, and the plane weighs less than a Ford Expedition, which is a pretty impressive combo of stats. But it's really slow. A Greyhound could outrun it. It's got a top speed of about 40 miles an hour, and a Greyhound, I think, tops out around 45 miles an hour. So it's a combination of a super light machine, super light materials, super big long wingspan, and just kind of harnessing technology in a way that's never been attempted before.
Okay, the dumb question maybe that pops into my head right away is, you're flying around the world, you're up in the air, and the sun goes down or a cloud goes up. I assume they don't come immediately plummeting to the ground. Why not?
It would be a very, very short test flight they did last year if that were the case. No, they have all kinds of workarounds, and they're actually going to do the flight over a 3 to 4 month period in sort of short stages. And, you know, there'll be the two test pilots doing this. They are the first to say, no, this is not going to be the way commercial solar flight is going to work. This is just a prototype, just kind of proof of concept showing people that it can be done. And once they do it, they're going to work on designing something that's a little more, I would say, realistic as a mode of transportation. But it's so exciting to think, you know, the sun is there, why not use it for energy?
So is that the ultimate goal, though, having a passenger plane with more than one person in it?
Well, I think that is the ultimate goal. Right now, they're just concerned about actually getting this thing off the ground and around the world without incident. Our writer covered this. She opens the story with this great description of how the wing, an early prototype of it, just kind of cracked under the pressure. And, you know, it's very much in its infant stages. And we'll see where it goes.
Well, another story you have this month, an interview with a molecular biologist. This blew my mind a little bit, who studies how bacteria can talk to each other, kind of an oh-no moment for humanity. What is bacterial communication? How do we know what they're saying to each other?
You know, I have to tell you, when our editor, one of the editors first brought this story up and we started talking about it, everybody, I think, in the room got a chill because it's like, wait, bacteria communicate and they plan actions? Oh, this is great. But yeah, it's something bacteria have been doing for 4 billion years. They communicate using chemical language. So they're not actually, you know, sidling up to each other and saying, hey, Bob, how you doing? They're actually, though, communicating through chemicals, through these three different molecules they've identified so far. There may be more, but they basically, they do something called quorum sensing. You know, if you have some random lone bacterium floating around your body, you're going to be okay. But if you have enough to obtain a quorum, they can actually decide to attack you in mass when they realize, hey, we've got enough of us to gang up on this host organism. And again, they do that through chemical signals between these molecules. What really blew my mind when we were talking about the story was that bacteria can actually identify each other within a species, and they can also communicate across species. So if you have, you know, a random bacterium of cholera floating around and it meets up with a random bacteria of E. coli, they can pretty much chemically say to each other, hey, I'm cholera. And the other one will be like, hey, I'm E. coli. Now, if that is not terrifying, I don't know what is.
That sounds like the worst party mixer ever in your body. I don't know.
Like, I've been to that party.
I join with Rob on this. This did kind of freak me out a little bit. So these bacteria can coordinate their actions. So I guess the idea being that they get a quorum and then suddenly they can instigate a disease in your body. So what are scientists going to do with this very freaky information now that we have it?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's when really the infection starts, when they achieve their quorum and they do something called auto-induce. and they do whatever naughty business they're going to do, whether it's attacking your body or, you know, not all bacteria are bad. Some of them are just like bioluminescent. So when they reach their quorum, they just glow, which is awful nice. But anyway, bacteria in general, they call this communication chatter. And what they're trying to do is basically shut them up to find ways of working with these molecules, sending out the chemical signals to shut them down. And maybe they send out the signal, but it's not understood. So the bacteria never realize that there are enough that they've achieved a quorum and could attack. There are all different ways that they're trying to shut them down, but it's basically shutting down the chat room.
And you mentioned bacteria have been doing this for 4 billion years or so. This is new to us and new to the world of science, isn't it?
Yeah, the field is only about 20 or 30 years, and it's really only, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years that they're actually identifying these molecules, zeroing in on how they communicate and also how they could potentially shut them down.
And that bioluminescent bacteria you mentioned, that was one of our first hints, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. This is actually way back in the 70s. They started to notice that just a couple of random bacteria floating in the Petri dish didn't do anything, but once they achieved their quorum, boom, they all lit up. And that's really where the research started.
So just to put it into context or to give us a silver lining on this parcel of what seems like it's sort of bad news, is what are some of the key diseases that could possibly be interrupted and halted if we figure out how to manipulate the bacteria quorum?
Well, the good/creepy thing is that all bacteria appear to have this ability to communicate. So any disease, any kind of infection that is bacterially induced, we have the potential, once we figure out how to shut them up, we have the potential to treat. The example the researcher Bonnie Bassler cited was Pseudomonas, which can be fatal, especially to someone with, say, cystic fibrosis. And if you can figure out a way to shut that down, chances are you're going to figure out a way to stop the chatter for a lot of other bacteria as well. It's pretty exciting.
Well, I'd like to be the first to welcome our new bacterial overlords. And I want to move on to one more story, though. And this one's a fun one, a new kind of soccer ball. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I love this story. There's this company in New York called Uncharted Play, and they came up with the Socket. It has two C's. And it is a soccer ball for all intents and purposes. Looks like a normal soccer ball. It's about 2 ounces heavier, but inside it has this whole kinetic energy mechanism that every time you kick it, every time it flies through the air, it is generating energy that is stored internally. And then after you play for 30 minutes, you can plug in a lamp, plug in your cell phone to charge, and you get 3 hours of power. And they designed this specifically for kids in the developing world because, you know, a lot of they don't have access to electricity. So when it's time to do homework, if the sun is down, what are they going to do? So the idea is they take the ball out, they play with it, kick it around for a while, come back in, plug in their light, through, you know, plug the light into the socket, and then they can do their homework. Or, you know, their parents can cook or whatever they need the electricity for. They can actually use it.
So is this technology that will be priced accessibly to people in the developing world?
Well, what they're doing right now, and this is the very early stages, it just came on the market, they're selling them in the developed world for about $100. But when you order it, every time you order it, they identify a child in a developing world country, and they put them on what they call a socket team. And once they get 5 kids, in other words, once one of us lucky folks in the developed world buys a socket, when you get 5 kids, they actually give them a socket ball. So right now, children in the developing world are not having to pay for them. And I think they're trying to keep that, you know, obviously as accessible and as affordable as possible.
And they found, I gather, that in some countries, soccer is a boy sport, not in others, obviously. What do they do for girls in those countries?
Yeah, I love this. When they were doing their test trials of the early versions, they noticed the girls never were playing soccer, but they were jumping rope. So they designed something called the Pulse. It's a jump rope. It uses very similar technology. And again, every time the rope turns, it's generating energy that is stored. And then you just plug in your USB right into the jump rope handles, and you can, again, charge your phone, use a light, all different applications.
Now, as a soccer ball goes or a jump rope goes, are these actually decent, you know, bits of play equipment? Can you play a decent game of soccer with the socket?
Yeah, in fact, the socket is actually rougher and tougher than a normal soccer ball that's just inflatable, because normal inflatable balls, they only last a few weeks, and then they go to the landfill because you can't really repair them after a time. The socket is designed to last 3 years. It has a really tough outer shell that stands up to all the kicking and all the rough ground that a lot of these playing fields are on. And it's also designed to be repaired using super basic parts. So, you know, if it's off in Africa or in India or somewhere and it breaks, they don't have to send it back to the manufacturer to get the super special part. They can just kind of jerry-rig it to work.
Gemma, did you get to play with either of these, the socket or the pulse?
No, I didn't, and I'm so mad about that.
Well, think of harnessing the energy of children. Talk about a renewable. I mean, they have a lot of energy, in my experience. This could be a good solution to a lot of problems.
It's a win-win situation, you know. The children get some exercise, get out in the fresh air, and then they have no excuse not to do their homework.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us, Gemma.
Always great. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us each month with some of the coolest stories from the worlds of science and technology.